In theory, this class is supposed to be video recorded. However, apparently nobody set it up for today, so I am audio recording it on my cell phone, which actually works pretty well, surprisingly. And hopefully from now on it'll be video recorded. This is intended partly so that if you want to review something, you can, partly so if you're homesick, you can do it, but mainly so that somebody 10,000 miles away who's interested in this stuff can get a free version of the class. It's struck me for a long time as one of the potentials of the Internet, that I have this feeling that, you know, somewhere in Shanghai or Bombay, there is this very bright 17-year-old who would really be interested in my ideas if only he could hear them. And since I can make it possible for free, I figure I might as well do it. The seating chart should be being passed around. There's lots of stuff up on the web. I hope you people have already found the web page for the class, but if you haven't, the web page for the class, all you really need is my web page address because it's got a link to the class in it. And my web, is this dark enough to be readable? Pretty bad. That's my web page. But then for the class, you add to that a bunch of more stuff. Academic / course pages. / L. I'll review the and. I'm not good on that. Funny symbol L and E. LF/14 _ law and econ14.html. So if you haven't found that, you should find it because that's got things like the syllabus and various other links that are going to be relevant. The main problem with this class from my standpoint is that your textbook was written from my class notes for this class 15 years ago or so. And I don't see a whole lot of point in your reading something and then my repeating it to you. So the way I'm going to try to structure it is that I will assume you have done the reading, that I will assume at the beginning of class that anything that was in the reading that doesn't make sense to you, you'll ask about. And if we do not exhaust the time in class responding to your questions, I will attempt to find enough interesting stuff relevant to the chapter that isn't in the chapter to fill it up. That's at least the strategy that I followed last time I taught this course and seemed to work better than essentially repeating myself by trying to summarize the chapters. The class has a midterm and a final. There are examples of past exams on the webpage that you can look at complete with answers. I attempt not to use any question in one of those example exams when I give the next exam, with rare exceptions, and I think the most useful way of using sample exams is to first do your studying and then test yourself, to essentially say, if this were the exam, would I be able to enter, to give the right answer to everything? And that, I think, is a useful approach. In addition to the midterm and the final, there is another requirement which is either a short classroom presentation or a short paper. And the basic idea of this is to pick some law case and assume you are arguing it before a judge who believes in economic analysis of law, which means Richard Posner or maybe Frank Easterbrook or someone else in that circuit, and try to write the case for one side on that assumption. So the idea is we're learning one way of thinking about law. One of the things that way can be used for is to argue cases, especially if you believe the judge believes in that way. And so an interesting way of seeing if you understand is to pick a case. You should not use any case that I discuss in the book or any case that Posner discusses in his book. Posner, a long time ago, wrote a very long treatise masquerading as a textbook called Economic Analysis of Law. I don't want to be told what Posner thinks about things. I want to be told what you think about things. But subject to that, you can take any current case, any past case, any case that has intrigued you for other reasons and say, well, if I was trying to persuade someone to believe in economic analysis of law, how would I do it for whichever side you prefer? You get to pick your side. And you can do that either as an in-class presentation, sort of a 10 or 15 minute summarizing your argument to the court, or if you prefer as a page, you know, as a 3 to 5 page text. Not intended to be fancy. I don't really care if you have lots of footnotes. I want to know if you understand the ideas and the basic idea. Everything that happens, hopefully after today, will be recorded and put up on the web. So if you have a mind to say anything that you would be embarrassed to have the world know you had said, better not say it. But on the whole, I generally ignored that problem. My wife has sometimes wondered why nobody has ever thrown a brick through our window, but so far they haven't. And you're graded primarily on the exam, somewhat on the paper presentation, and I try to tweak it a little bit for how much you help me teach the class by saying interesting things in class, but I'm not very good about that. So one of the functions of the seating chart is so that I can make a little note saying, so and so said something interesting today. But that's not a major element. So before I start talking about economics, do you have any questions about the class, economics, or anything else? No. Okay. What is economics? Anybody have an opinion on what economics, how does economics differ from psychology or physics or any other field of human endeavor? What is it?
Study of choice.
What if we observed people who made all their choices by flipping coins? Would that be economics?
They said that since you have a budget and you can't spend more than you have, even if you've made every decision perfectly randomly, it would still fit into the model, so to speak.
Well, would you? Would there be any particular reason, depending? I guess it would depend on which decisions you made first, but if your decision of what to buy for dinner was made before other decisions that exhausted your budget, there's no reason why raising the price of the food would make you buy any less of it, right? It would only do that if it was sort of randomly allocated so that you ran out of money faster if it was more expensive. Anybody have any questions? I believe I had the beginning of the book as the readings for today. Anybody have any questions on that? Anything there that didn't make sense to you? But if you thought it was wrong, that's even better.
I was wondering about, I'm not sure like what part it was, but at a certain point you state that you start from the assumption that every human is rational, and you kind of question it by saying, well, is this the case? And you give an example with like chips and stuff. And then you conclude, well, sometimes we make irrational decisions. But I wouldn't actually call them irrational decisions, because if someone makes a decision which is, like, if you look at it afterwards, is wrong, I wouldn't necessarily call it irrational. It's just that the person at the time of making his decision, he just used variables, and some variables to him were, like, unknown, and that's why he made a certain decision, but his decision was still the result of irrational.
Let me go back a step, because my answer to the question I started with is that I think of economics as the approach to understanding behavior that starts from the assumption that individuals have objectives and tend to take the actions to achieve them, which is rationality in some sense. And it's not an assumption that's limited to human beings. But my favorite non-human example is genes. Can anybody tell me why it is that in most species, including ours, roughly half the babies are male and half are female? Yes.
That maximizes propagation of the genetic material.
I don't understand what that means. Why does it maximize the propagation of the genetic material? Both males and females carry genes. If anything, females carry a little bit more genetic material because they've got two X chromosomes, and the X chromosome is bigger than the Y chromosome. So
it'll result in a higher possibility for variance and mutations, because if you have half male and half female, then you have increased amount of combinations that are possible.
Any other answers? This question was, I should say, answered by a guy called R.A. Fisher, who I met when I was about 10 years old, who was at the time one of the world's leading statisticians and one of the world's leading geneticists. And what's neat about it is that it comes from the fact that genes are rational. that if you think about Darwinian evolution, what it implies is that we are designed for reproductive success. People talk about it in terms of survival, but if you survive and never reproduce, your genes disappear. All right? So the max demand we are designed for is basically the number of our genes that show up in later generations. And it's a little tricky because one way of doing it is to reproduce. Another way is to keep your brother alive since he's got half your genes or your cousin or whatever. That's what we refer to as extended reproductive success. But the basic logic is the same. Suppose we had a species where two-thirds of the children were female. All right. Every baby has got both a father and a mother. So if two-thirds of the children are female, the average male has twice as many children as the average female. Does that follow? Yes? No? Obvious? Not obvious. So imagine that you think of yourself as a rational gene trying to decide whether to make the person carrying you produce sons or daughters. A gene that makes you more likely to produce sons will result in more grandchildren than one that makes you more likely to produce daughters, everything else being equal. Does that make sense? So therefore, if you had a population where a majority of the offspring were female, you would expect that genes reproducing males would increase in that population because they would produce more grandchildren. And you would thus be driven back to an equilibrium reproductive system. Now it's a little bit tricky because this is assuming that the cost of producing a son and a daughter is the same, biological cost. So if you have a species with a lot of sexual dimorphism, a species where, such as elephant seals, where the males are much bigger than the females, presumably it costs larger biological resources for the mother to produce a son than to produce a daughter, and you would then get an unequal result. But since we're sexual dimorphism isn't that large in humans, you end up with something very close to this. And part of the reason I like that example is that it feels a whole lot like the kind of economic market analysis where you say if you can produce either of two kinds of goods and they are equally easy to produce but one of them sells for a higher price, then people will shift into producing the higher priced one. That will drive down the price and you end up with equal prices. So essentially it's a biological equivalent of an economic argument, which is sort of fun about it. But it's also neat in that it shows how the rationality assumption can be used in any context where you observe, where you expect the choice to be made in order to maximize an objective, not just limited to the normal economic context of human beings choosing. Okay. So anyway, at least for my purposes, the essential assumption of economics is rationality, and rationality means that. And as you were commenting, then the question is it true? And you want to claim it's more true than I think it is, and I want to say perhaps not. And my standard argument is not yours that it was really rational, because I would say, what if, in terms of all the information you had at the time, choice A was the choice that achieved your objectives, and choice B was the one that didn't, and you made B. So that my standard argument is rather that rational behavior is an imperfect description of what we do, but we don't have a decent description of the alternative. That is, saying people will make mistakes doesn't say what mistakes they're going to make. And that therefore, you are better off assuming that people are rational and realizing sometimes you'll be wrong than assuming nothing, essentially, and not being able to predict behavior. And in addition, there are at least some contexts, though not all, in which the irrationality cancels out. So if you think about, if you imagine, suppose we're just thinking about the ordinary economic demand curves, and the question is, price of hamburger goes up, what happens? And if individuals follow the economic models, price of hamburger goes up, quantity of hamburger bought goes down. If people follow the models and then flip a coin to decide whether to buy a pound more or a pound less than the model says, you'll get the same result because you're summing over lots of people and the coin flips average out. So that's one reason why at least some of the time the assumption might do better than you might make up for the unrealism of the assumption. You were going to say something.
Yeah, I was going to say something because I think we just have different definitions of rationality. When I hear you speaking, I think you see rationality as making the right decision. But I see rationality as simple as a process of weighing off the measure.
Yes, I would have said no because to begin with, a whole lot of rational behavior is not done by explicit thinking at all. A lot of rational behavior is done by trial and error. So that if you, one of the, my story may or may not be true, but about non-human rationality involved cats. So if you ever had a cat as a roommate, and it's in the morning, you are reading the newspaper when you should be petting the cat solution is light on the newspaper. Now you can't read the newspaper, so you pet the cat. I'm not sure if it's true, I don't have enough data, but it seems to me to make sense. But if that's happening, it's not because the cat knows what a newspaper is. It's because the cat once lay down on the newspaper and it works. So that's a trial and error method. And in my genetic case, my rational genes aren't doing any thinking at all. They're acting as if they thought because of the selection through Darwinian evolution. So I think thinking about the process is probably not the most useful way of doing it. I agree that rationality is a very complicated idea, because what about the person who has incorrect information? He makes the wrong decision, maybe being rational. You can, in a sense, think about the rationality assumption being pushed further and further down. So the simplest version of the one you're going to use most of the time, I think, is people tend to make the right choice. A next step might be to make the right choice about acquiring information, which may mean they ultimately make the wrong choice because they have correctly concluded that the information to make the right choice costs more than it's worth. So if you think about the application of economics to politics, which is called public choice theory, and one of the immediate results is what's called rational ignorance. And rational ignorance is that the individual voter knows that how he votes in a large polity has almost no chance of influence. It therefore does not matter. He has no good reason to spend time and effort figuring out who's a better candidate. He might have a reason to spend time and effort figuring out which candidate his friends approve of, because if he tells the truth, he might lose friends if he votes the wrong one. And I've read some stuff recently by somebody at Yale on a different version of the same line, having to do with controversies such as global warming or evolution. And it's really quite striking because it's completely crazy and it makes perfectly good logical sense. And the reason he's looking at those controversies where a position has become identified with group identification. So that if you are a modern American academic and you tell people you don't believe in evolution, you will lose an awful lot of reputation. If you are a fundamentalist Christian in a small town and you tell people you do believe in evolution, you'll lose a lot of reputation. It turns out that if you take an issue like that and you have a measure essentially of how scientifically sophisticated people are, how much they know about science, that within groups where not believing in evolution is a mark of group identity, the more sophisticated you are, the more likely you are to not believe in evolution. Ditto for global warming. All right? And that seems really weird, but then you think about, wait a minute, what's the rational thing to do? You say to yourself, whether or not I believe in evolution, it's going to have no effect on the world. It's going to have a big effect on my little social world, though, because people care about this thing. If I'm really clever and sophisticated, I can think of good reasons, of persuasive reasons to reject the argument in favor of evolution. So I'll do an even better job than the person who is And it's very striking, exactly the same kind of issue. So in one sense, people are being irrational, and at least half, one side or the other is reaching the wrong conclusion on each of these issues. And yet in another sense, they're behaving rationally. So there are some issues such as rational ignorance where you want to push your rationality assumption at least to being rational about deciding what to spend on getting the information and decisions. But I think most of the time it's probably sufficient to just use a simple version. They tend to make the right decision, but not perfect. Now, another reason why rationality sometimes works better than you might expect is that you sometimes aren't dealing with random people. So if you're thinking about firms, for example, if the president of the firm doesn't tend to act in the way that maximizes profit, after a while either he stops being president or the firm goes out of business. So you would expect that on average, firms would come closer to behaving rationally than individuals doing that. That makes sense. And I think one of the patterns you often see sort of in casual conversation is somebody saying, look, that firm is being really stupid. Why doesn't it do X instead of Y? I do that too. I got various ideas on how airlines load taxes or something like that. And I think the economist's bias ought to be to say the firm probably knows what it's doing. And so what you have is not a result but a puzzle. What you have is the question of why don't they do X, Y, or Z? And that's an interesting puzzle in the way of doing economics. And there are a number of these puzzles, but sort of one of my standard puzzles is why do you have restaurants which have predictable long lines? All right, imagine you're running a restaurant and every Friday evening people have to wait 45 minutes to get in. Well, suppose you raise your prices. Every time, in effect, those people are paying the price of the food plus a 45-minute wait. That's a cost. Suppose you raised your prices by the equivalent to them of the cost of a half-hour wait. Your line would go down 15 minutes because people, when people say there's a half-hour wait plus this higher price, now not worth going. Yep.
But isn't that problem more complex because the long line may entice other people to go there anyway?
It might, but why aren't people exactly equally entitled by the high price? You see two restaurants. One of them charges $20 for dinner and has a 45-minute line, and one of them charges $30 and has a 15-minute line. Why don't you say, huh, must be about equally good food because people are only willing to wait half an hour more for this one when they're assuming the half an hour is what $10 represents.
But so they may have other motivations, right? They may want to go there because that's the trendy restaurant where they want to see.
Sure.
You know, and it doesn't matter. What matters is it has a long line, therefore.
But why? But what objective of theirs is achieved by going to one with a long line? Because they could just as easily say, look, I went to this restaurant which people are willing to pay $30 for. I'm from too long ago. It's probably $100 nowadays for a fancy restaurant to go into. But anyway, the general point I'm making is that when you see these patterns, your first guess ought to be there is a reason for it, and then they say it's an interesting puzzle one. Now, I should say, since I wrote this book and various other books that discuss this question, there has been some work which really challenges my argument about no theory of mistakes. There was a very interesting book by a man called Kahneman, who is a psychologist who got a Nobel Prize in economics, and I think deserved it. And the book is called Thinking Fast and Slow. And have any of you read it?
No.
It's worth reading if you have the time. It's a theory of mistakes. But oddly enough, it's a rational theory of mistakes. So it's not entirely clear whether you should describe that as contradicting economics or expanding it. Because Kahneman's argument goes as follows. He says, look, we have two different mechanisms for analyzing data. One of them, I look around me, and I am not seeing a patch of yellow with black lines across it and a sort of a slightly tannish blob above it and some darker brown above that. I'm seeing a human being wearing a yellow shirt with black stripes and a face and hair. All right? There's got to be a whole lot of image processing that went in there somewhere. All right? If you try to think of actually taking what's input into your retina, which is basically a pattern of colors, that's not what any of us sees. What all of us see is an actual world which makes sense. That's a table, that's a chair, and so forth. There is no rational behavior in the normal, in your sense of it, going into there. It's not that I run through a calculation. How do I know that that's dark brown hair rather than a bit of a splotch of paint on the wall behind it? I don't go through that. It all happens automatically. Similarly, you hear somebody's voice and you know who it is. How do you do it? I don't know. You do. So Kahneman's point is that's one process. That's what he calls the fast mind. And then there's the slow mind, which is what we normally think of as rational thinking. Rational thinking is a scarce resource. We have a limited amount of time. We couldn't possibly get through the world doing rational thinking for all that stuff. On the other hand, in order to be fast, the fast mind has to use all sorts of rules of thumb, all sorts of approximate rules for making sense of things, which are sometimes wrong. And therefore, you can understand to some extent what mistakes people will make by doing research, which he and his coworker, Tversky, no longer alive, did to figure out what the rules of thumb are that the fast mind uses and then where it's wrong. And part of what's fun about the book is that he makes the reader an experimental subject, that he's got repeated cases where he gives you sort of a little puzzle. And one of two things happens. Either you immediately get the wrong answer, or you immediately get the wrong answer, realize it's wrong, and then correct it to the right answer. And these are all rigged so that they exploit mistakes the fast mind makes. So that, to take one example, which I should have copied it out from the book. I've got it somewhere. But the example goes something like the following. Jane was a student at university. What's the University of California that's on the sea south of here that's very sort of... Santa Cruz. University of Santa Cruz, majored in environmental studies, volunteered for such and such, went to law school. Which is more likely, that she is a law school, that she is now a lawyer, or that she is now a lawyer specializing in environmental subjects? Yeah. Has to be, because one of them is a subset of the other. But your first instinct is to say, lawyer specializing in environmental subjects fits the pattern I've got, the picture of Jane I've got. And that's largely how the fast mind works, right? And there are some of them are less obvious than that. And in fact, I don't remember if he gives it, but his analysis gives you a possible answer to a puzzle that economists have been worrying about since at least Adam Smith. And that puzzle is what we call the lottery insurance puzzle. Why is it that some people both buy lottery tickets and buy insurance? On the face of it, insurance is a way of reducing the uncertainty of your world at a price. Lottery tickets are a way of increasing the uncertainty at a price. And why would it make sense to do both? And I don't remember whether Kahneman actually has this or is just something that I deduced from his argument. But a possible explanation goes as follows. The fast mind is not very good at probability theory or probability calculation. So it basically analyzes issues into three categories. Impossible, possible, and certain. All right? And if you think about a lot of how people think, that if you think about sort of low probability, terrible risks, what are the chances of having AIDS if you have sex? Well, the answer is that for ordinary sex, if there's nothing particularly wrong with you, the chance is very, 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 very tiny. But it exists, and it therefore affects you. And that's true of lots of other things. Every time, I don't know whether maybe you're sufficiently used to taking off on airplanes, it doesn't bother you. But there's a certain tendency when an airplane is taking off, to say, well, you know, it's true airplanes hardly ever crash, but it could happen, and they're a little bit scared just now, even though, the odds are extraordinarily low. So there's some sense in which your unthought analysis is possible, not how likely. Well, what does insurance do? It moves a bad outcome, your house burns down, you have no money, from possible to impossible, because now you'll get the insurance because of it. What does a lottery ticket do? It moves a very good outcome from impossible to possible, namely you get $1 million. Both of those look like big positive changes, and so you do both of them, even though in some sense it makes no sense. So Kahneman is, in a sense, an interesting challenge to economics, and I'm not going to go much beyond that except to point you at him, because it's intellectually neat and exciting and fun to read. So, it's not clear how far you can go with it. It's not clear that knowing that really will make you change any of the basic economic theories. There's a book by Cass Sunstein and someone else called Nudges, which is an attempt to use Kahneman's ideas somehow. But at least my conclusion was it didn't tell me very much useful. So much on rationality and what economics is. Any questions so far? Feel free to stop me at any point, because I tend not to be easily stopped. Yeah.
Just to clarify, yeah. When you speak of the genes acting rationally, I assume that's metaphorical to be like the observed behaviors, they act as if they are.
That's right. That is to say the gene, the pattern of the outcome of what genes are in the gene pool, it looks like a pattern you would get if genes were trying to decide what should I be in order to maximize reproduction. Yeah, exactly. And going back for a moment to my stuff about science and group identification, it isn't, a lot of people want to think about it as, well, the left believes in science and the right doesn't. But the real pattern, if you look at it, is that everybody disbelieves in science when it leads to conclusions they don't like and believes in conclusions they do like. Because not a perfect split, but there's some left-right split on the question of is intelligence heritable, all right? Because there's been some historical pattern, at least for the last 50 years or so, of the political left wanting to think of people determined by environment and the right wanting to think of the left. So, well, it's very hard to see how human beings could have evolve to be intelligent if intelligence is not heritable. So it looks like a case where, in this case, it's the left which would prefer to ignore what looks like the implication of the science, just as parts of the right do on evolution. The right is probably too broad, but at least those religious views that find the evolution inconsistent with the biblical account have a reason to not believe in it, and then figure out reasons not to believe in it. I think you see that. I can give lots of other examples, but I think you see that pattern pretty much across. And I should say you should look for it, especially in yourself, that because that's the hardest one to criticize. Try to figure out where you have beliefs, which you have because it would be uncomfortable for you not to hold them, rather than because you have good reasons to believe them. I tried to get the guy at Yale, who I know is doing this research that I described, to apply that to himself, but he didn't seem interested in that project. By basically suggesting to him some propositions which it would make him unpopular as a member of the Yale Law School to publicly hold, but which there are strong arguments for. So think about it in that sense for yourself. All right, so what is economics applied to law? And to begin with, I would say that before I get to law for a moment, I'm an economic imperialist. That is, I think that economics can be, you can try to use economics to understand a very wide range of subjects. My first published economics journal article was A Theory of the Size and Shape of Nations, which purported to explain the general characteristics of the map of Europe from the fall of the Roman Empire to the present. And that was one in which governments, states, were acting like rational individuals trying to maximize their net tax revenue. And the basic model there was you've got two countries and some land in between them. Each country implicitly says to itself, how much more tax revenue net of the cost of collecting it would we get if we ruled this country, this territory? Whichever one, the number comes out higher on average gets it, because they're willing to fight harder, bribe harder, do whatever it is necessary to do it. And then there are some circumstances in which a piece of land is worth more to a big country than a small country, and you then tend to get big countries and some that go the other way around. If you're sufficiently curious, if you just look at the first part of that, the daviddfriedman.com, that's my webpage, and there are links to most of my articles, including that one. It was a fun article. So I would have said that the basic approach of the economic imperialist is to say we find out whether something is economic by trying to apply economics to make sense of it. If we get good results, then it looks as though economics is useful for it. There's a very interesting book by an economist called The Invisible Hook, which is an analysis of the economics of the piracy industry back in the 18th century. And I think it works. That is, I think the answer is that you actually understand things about how that works better than you would understand it without economics. And it's, again, economics in this very broad sense of it. For example, the reason that the pirates used pirate flags was to avoid free riding on their reputation by the Coast Guard. That was Coast Guard in the 18th century sense. So what's going on by his description is that the pirates want a particular reputation. They want the reputation that if you resist us, we'll treat you very badly. But if you surrender, we'll treat you well. And they mostly did. The Coast Guard would like that reputation. The Coast Guard basically are only entitled to seize ships within territorial waters, that they're more or less enforcing, anti-smuggling and related rules. The Coast Guard, therefore, would like people to think they're pirates, the ships they're chasing down. So the pirates fly a flag, which has become identified with piracy. Piracy is a bad and illegal thing, so the Coast Guard are very reluctant to explicitly pretend to be pirates. So that would be one example. There are lots of other examples. And in a sense, the big puzzle about piracy is why it was such a democratic system for the ships, that the organization of a pirate ship was a one-man, one-vote system for the crew, and the division of the loot was almost completely even, that you had two officers, the captain and the quartermaster. They got about two or three shares of loot each. Everybody else got one share, and maybe there were some cabin boys or something about half a share. It was pretty close to even. You compare that to the British Navy at the same time, And the British Navy has a system of prize money where if you capture or sink an enemy ship, you get a bunch of money. If I remember correctly, a third of that money goes to the captain of the ship. This is a ship and I have 200 people in it. Another third to the officers, and the last third is divided among the crew of several hundred people. Right? Why so different? All right? And why, for that matter, weren't merchant ships run like pirate ships? If that form of organization worked for the pirate ships, I should say, the captain and the quartermaster are elected by majority vote and can be removed at any time. The captain commands in battle and the quartermaster not in battle. It's the basic system. Peter Leeson's book, and Invisible Book, you might find it fun. But anyway, and I think the ultimate answer is that pirate ships are worthless. That the pirates are capturing more ships than they can crew. They can't easily sell them given they're engaged in an illegal market. Therefore, the important asset on a pirate ship is the crew, whereas the asset on a merchant ship is the ship plus the cargo. So if a merchant ship was run the way a pirate ship was run, the crew would, in effect, double-cross the owners. They would do whatever maximized their welfare, even if it didn't get the goods to the market as quickly as possible and so forth, and therefore you end up with a relatively tyrannical rule by the captain in the merchant ships and in the warships, and a democratic system for the pirate ships. So that's another interesting example where if you try to use economic approaches to make sense of things, you can actually, to some extent, understand things that other people would have thought had nothing to do with economics. So anyway, so that's two good books. For all your copious spare time in law school, I've now recommended two good books, Thinking Fast and Slow by Kahneman and The Invisible Hook by Leeson. I should say, I think The Invisible Hook is a cheating title because his argument is not really analogous to Adam Smith's Invisible Hand, which is what he's referring to, but it's a catchy title, and that's a good book. All right, so we try to apply the economic approach as broadly as possible and see if it works. And in the legal context, that means that we want to apply it to all of the players, that we want to assume that criminals are rational, we want to assume that victims are rational, that tortfeasors are rational, that tort victims are rational, that policemen are rational, that judges are rational, and the legislators are rational. In practice, as the field has developed, it's focused a good deal more on the people who the legal system is applied to than the people applying it. But that, it seems to me, just means there's more work to be done, that you want to figure out how is it in the interest of police to behave. That's at the moment sort of a fairly high-profile issue because of the stuff going on in Ferguson. You'd like to figure out, aside from whoever side you think you're on, one of the things that strikes me in anything like this Ferguson controversy is that half the world is certain that one account of what happened is true, and half the world is certain the other. And each of them treats the other as if they were ignoring the obvious facts, whereas as far as I can tell so far, we don't actually know whether the guy who shot the, whatever his name was in imminent peril of having his gun grabbed and being shot, or whether he was just an irresponsible person who said, hey, let's kill this guy, or anything in between. But anyway, it would be nice to know what the incentives of cops are, and there's been a little bit of thinking that depends on that, but more for the actors it's applied to. So how does that apply to legal systems in general? How does the economic approach? And basically, you can think of a system of legal rules as a set of incentives. You would say, if I do this, that will happen to me. If I murder somebody under the following circumstances, I will be arrested and tried and hanged or jailed or whatever. If I drive carelessly and run into somebody, here is what will happen. And you can then say, for any hypothetical set of legal rules, how will rational people behave? And there are then two directions that you can apply the analysis. One of them is to say, use economics to figure out, if I have this legal rule, what will happen? Do I like it? If I like it, I'm in favor of the rule. If I don't like it, I'm not. A different way it can be applied is to say, here is a system of legal rules. Here is a guess at the objective it was designed to achieve. Can we understand why the rules are what they are as designed to get a particular outcome? All right. And those are, I think, two different things that are in practice going on at the same time. Questions? Yes?
Well, one question. Doesn't that assume that regardless the size of the legal rules, everybody is going to be aware of the existence of the rules and the incentives. So my point is, if the system gets so large that you can't comprehend all of the rules and you're not even aware of it, then your actions can't be rational.
Well, your actions will still be affected by what you know about the rules, but what you know about the rules will be very imperfect. Of course, that's true in other contexts as well. If you think about buying a car, nobody is really well enough informed to make a perfect decision about buying a car. You know, for all you know, and I gather Kia has been doing pretty well, and so for all you know, having never driven a Kia, maybe it would be a better deal than the Honda you decided to buy, but you can't search all cars, and so you can do the best you can. So similarly, I think it's a legitimate question to say to what extent are people aware of what the rules are, and in some cases the rule may not matter. There's in fact quite an interesting book, which I think I discussed much later in your reading, called Order Without Law by Robert Ellison, law professor at Yale. And it has to do with a private legal system a few hours from here, where certain legal issues are not a private legal system that trumps the law of the state of California. It's a system of norms of neighborly behavior. This is a rural county, Shasta County, if you know where it is. But Ellison originally looked at Shasta County because there is a very famous article that we'll be talking about later by Ronald Coase, which implies that legal rules have less effect than you might expect because of individual bargaining. So the Coasean, one of the examples, many examples that Coase runs through, is consider the question of open range versus closed range. The open range rule, which used to be the rule in the U.S. West for a long time, is that a rancher is entitled to let his cattle stray. And if you're a farmer, it's up to you to put a fence around your field to make sure the cattle don't damage your crop. Closed range is the other way around. Closed range says that if your cattle stray onto someone else's field and do damage, you're liable for the damage, and therefore it's your responsibility to fence your cattle. And Coase argued that at least under some circumstances, it wouldn't matter which rule you had. Because if the rule was closed range, but it was in fact cheaper to put your fence around the grain field rather than put the fence around the range, then the ranchers would make a deal with the farmers saying, we'll pay the cost of fencing in your field so that we don't have to put fences around. So the basic argument was that as long as transaction costs are low, individual bargaining will move you to the efficient outcome, whatever the legal. And Ellison discovered that Shasta County, by pure accident, was a patchwork of open range and closed range in terms of legal rules. And so we went looking to see if Coase was right. And it turned out that Coase's conclusion was right, but the reason had nothing to do with Coase's argument. That what was really going on, and this is really the main subject of Ellison's book, was that Shasta County's certain issues were determined by a system of private norms, of norms of neighborly behavior. And the norms of neighborly behavior about what you were supposed to do if you were a good neighbor when your cattle trespass on somebody else's tomato crop were the same whether you were in open range or closed range. And the reason that the norms of neighborly behavior trumped the laws of California was that one of the norms of neighborly behavior is that good neighbors don't sue each other. So therefore, you never get to court, and what really matters is that the people around you think you're a decent person because it's sort of hard living in a rural county where everybody hates you. So that's the third class book, Order Without Law. It covers lots of other things as well, but that was sort of the main inspiration for it. So that's a case where it's not that the logic of economics is wrong, it's just that we're looking at the wrong set of incentives, the wrong set of things. And there's a different one that I've wondered about, and somebody else probably knows much more about than I do. But at the moment, the U.S. tends to have very high crime rates in inner-city poor areas. Not in most other areas. And the question is why. And it's tempting for an economist to say, well, it has something to do with the probability of being caught and punished when you commit a crime, and that certainly is one relevant thing. But I wonder if what's really going on is that in functioning societies, the main thing that keeps people honest is not that at all, but systems of norms. That the main thing that's going on is if you're a burglar, probably your neighbors know you're a burglar. And if they know you're a burglar, they're not going to be very willing to rent an apartment to you or to let their daughters date you or to, you know, do other things. And if what's happened is that in the inner city, that system of norm enforcement is broken down for some reason. and the system of legal enforcement, which is what we mostly pay attention to, isn't adequate to do the job. But that would be another example of the same point. So, no, I agree that sort of, again, when things don't happen the way the theory says they should, that's a puzzle. So one of the things one might at some point conclude is we've done the economic analysis, we're sure we've got it right, X should be happening, X isn't happening. Maybe we're looking at the wrong set of incentives. Maybe the incentives that really matter to people are different ones. But anyway, right. So let me go on to talk about a particular theory about what the legal system is doing, which has played a large role in the economic analysis of law as it has developed, although in my view it is not an essential part of it. And this is the idea of what we usually call economic efficiency. For anybody who reads Posner, he called it wealth maximization for reasons I do not understand. But the basic idea, which is an idea that runs through a lot of economics, is to ask, can you make any useful answer to the question, are the net effects of something good or bad? All right? Because if you think of almost any major decision, say imposing a tariff or changing from strict liability to negligence or imposing a death penalty or removing a death penalty, it's going to affect lots of people. And some of the effects are going to be good and some of them are going to be bad. And you'd like some way of summing them up. And in principle, this is a problem for moral philosophy. Moral philosophy is a field whose rate of progress is sufficiently slow that people still read Aristotle. And so economists end up offering a very poor but usable alternative to a good philosophical answer. And that alternative is called economic efficiency. And economic efficiency is to say, consider any change. Suppose you could ask everybody affected, suppose everybody affected knew how the change would affect him, and suppose you could ask everybody, how much money would you pay to either make this change happen or stop from happening? Add up those sums where what you would pay to make the change happen is positive, to stop it is negative. If the sum is positive, we call it an improvement. All right? So it's not a very good answer to the question. In particular, one of the points that people who think about it often note is a rich person is willing to spend more dollars to get what he wants than a poor person. That doesn't mean it's more important. But it does have the virtue that economics sometimes tells us how do you get efficient outcomes? How do you step things up so that things that have net positive effects happen and things that have net negative effects don't happen? And it's not clear that you can do that for any more sophisticated measure. Person who I think originally came up with the idea, though he didn't call it economic efficiency, was Alfred Marshall, who a little over 100 years ago more or less put together modern economics. Now Marshall was a utilitarian. He was somebody who in fact thought that the right criterion was total human happiness. And his argument was that most of the things we're looking at affect a wide and sort of random mix of people. So if something produces net dollar, or in his case, pound gains for the inhabitants of London, then probably it produces net happiness gains because some of the inhabitants of London are rich and some of them are poor and some of them like money and some of them don't like money and so forth and similarly. So he was clearly viewing it not as an ultimately perfect solution, but as a fairly usable one. That's the idea of economic efficiency. An efficient outcome is one that can't be improved. Economic improvement and efficiency means something where the net gains are greater than the net loss. And it's a useful and powerful concept that I've spent a good deal of time arguing with people about global warming. And almost all of the global warming argument is on the question of whether it's happening and why. And almost none of it is on the really interesting question, which is whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. All right, if you think about the effects of raising the temperature of the world by a degree or two, it's pretty clear that there are both good and bad effects. That, you know, if you live in Chicago and have been through a Chicago winter, you would say, well, you know, a couple of degrees warmer would be really nice, wouldn't it? If you make things a little bit warmer, growing seasons for crops are longer. CO2 is an input to photosynthesis, so that's going to make some. On the other hand, you're going to have sea level rise, you're going to have hotter summers, and so forth and so on. So the question people ought to be asking, it seems to me, ought to be arguing about is, assume that the best guesses of the climate people are right. And I think they're only guesses. I've argued this enough so that I think our certainty of what's happening is not very good. That if you look at the IPCC predictions, they haven't fared very well in the past. But that's because it's a hard problem. But assume that we're willing to take the IPCC estimates as the best guess. What's the result for humans? And I don't think it's at all clear whether it's good or bad. And yet almost everyone ignores that and pushes on the other on the other side of it. But that's an economic efficiency problem, basically, trying to net all of these things. So Richard Posner, who was, as you may know, he's now a federal judge, but he was one of the major figures in the development of the economic analysis of law. And I used his book before I wrote mine. And at one point, I think I sent him comments on his book, which were about a tenth as many pages as the book was after he was teaching it for a number of years and finding things that I agreed and disagreed with on it. But Posner offered a very interesting conjecture back 50 years ago or about, it must be close to 50 years ago. And his conjecture was that the common law, which presumably you as law students actually know what the term means, although many people don't, that the common law could best be understood as a set of rules as if designed to maximize economic efficiency. All right? So that's a very interesting conjecture, that you can understand why, to take one example where I think you have a pretty good argument, why you have strict liability for ultra-hazardous activities. That's one of the ones he discusses. He offered reasons to think that it was the economically efficient rule to have strict liability for ultra-hazardous activities, but negligent liability for many other kinds of activities. And the basic argument, we'll come back to that later, but the basic argument there is that you want people to take precautions if and only if the precautions are worth taking. If spending $100 checking your brakes more often only reduces accident costs by $10, then you're worse off. We are worse off doing it. If it reduces it by $200, we're better off. Now he says that a court might be able to tell whether you drove dangerously, but the court is not in a position to tell whether you should have driven at all, how important the trip was, so to speak. So one of the variables that affects the chance of accidents is activity level, how much you do something. You ought to pick that optimally as well. But if we have a negligence standard, if you aren't negligent in what you're doing, there is no legal risk to doing more of it, even if when you're not negligent, there's still some risk. So therefore, he said, if you have an activity where the critical precaution is not doing it at all, for example, removing tree stumps with dynamite, which is a lot cheaper than digging them up, but has certain risks. Therefore, we will say in that case we'll have strict liability, which says however carefully you did it, if somebody gets hurt, you're liable. And that way you are now receiving as a private cost the cost of the risks you're imposing on other people, even if you're careful. And if the critical thing is to give you an incentive not to do it unless it's really worth doing, rather than just to give you an incentive to do it carefully. So that would be one example, but it's got a thick book full of examples. So it's been a very interesting conjecture. I'm not sure if it's true. Well, by the end of the semester, you'll be in a better position to have an opinion on that. I discuss that at the end of the book. Whether it's true or not, however, it was a very productive conjecture because it got people thinking about ways of looking at law which unifies it. That it turns out that if you think about the logic of optimal tort law and the logic of optimal contract law and the logic of optimal criminal law, and in each case, you say, what are the rules that would maximize economic efficiency? You discover that you've run into the same argument three times. And this, I should say, is part of the reason why economic analysis of law is both tempting and threatening to non-economist legal scholars. It's tempting. There's something you probably know more clearly than I do, is the degree to which an ordinary course in law involves learning a bunch of separate things. You've got to learn evidence law. You've got to learn economic analysis. No, they're not separate things at all. Here's a set of arguments, a set of ways of thinking. We take these tools, they make sense of criminal law. So that's very tempting and interesting, but also sort of threatening, because here I'm saying to all of my colleagues, I've never been to law school, I'm not a lawyer, I'm saying, look, you people, if you really want to understand your subject, you've got to go back to school and learn economics. And naturally enough, that's not always a popular thesis to offer me. So in any case, let me get back to where I was. So Posner offered the conjecture, and can anybody hear? Here's the question. Suppose you were, you by now know, would you, I assume you're all second and third year students. You know a good deal of law. Can you think of a common law legal rule which clearly is wrong from the standpoint of economic efficiency? Evidence against the Posner conjecture. I should say the evidence for the Posner, in my opinion, has never given a good theoretical reason for why you'd expect the common law to be efficient. What he's done is to give a whole lot of examples. And the trouble with that is that once you know what the efficient answer is, once you know what the legal rule is, if the situation is complicated, you can usually find some way of showing it's efficient. And we will come across, by the time we're finished, at least one situation where you have exactly the same argument in two different parts of the law. The legal rule makes the opposite choice in the two, and Posner in different places separately has argued that each of them is the efficient decision. But can you think of, can any of you think of some feature of the common law that you have come across that is inconsistent with the Posner conjecture? Yes?
There is some people argue as far as patent law is concerned.
As far as what?
Patent law.
Yes.
Specifically applies to software.
But patent law is not copy. It's not common law.
Patent law
is legislative law.
Is it common law originally or
it's not part of the common law. So the patent statutes are statutes, are federal statutes.
Yeah, that.
Not judge-made law.
But, like, in a sense, everything derives from...
You can certainly argue that...
intellectual property.
But intellectual property comes out of the U.S. Constitution, not out of common law.
Which is itself derived from older...
There certainly are traditional, but insofar as one distinguishes between legislative law and common law, right, one would normally describe intellectual property as coming out of legislative law. It comes out of patent statutes, not coming out of judges' decisions or what's implied by. But in any case, but you want to argue that patent law itself is not economically efficient. Why?
Just in the specific sphere of its application to software, and it's like I've heard this argument from people who work with this kind of thing and know better than I do.
Yep.
But the idea behind the patents originally is to ensure that there's been kind of a reward for innovation and that you can reap the benefits of what you've done. Yep. But the way that software works is that everything's built on top of each other and that by going through the patent system, you end up stifling innovation and people can't build off of what you've done and create more efficient ways to do things.
Yep. The class I'm going to be teaching in about another hour is an IP theory class. And in addition to reading a standard book on it, I'm also reading chapters from a book called Against Intellectual Monopoly, which is a book which is making the argument much more generally than you are. The authors are arguing that the patent and copyright are all a mistake, that we'd be better off without either of them. And true to their principles, the book is up on the web, so one can read it for free. Yeah.
It's interesting, but that also ties into what you were talking about, how sometimes we're not looking at all the different incentives that people are using, and sometimes there are also different norms within an industry that shape it. And I actually took an IP survey class over the summer, and the professor was talking about how in some cases, because programmers know that in order to use their code, someone's going to have to go through, you know, the onerous, you know, the software protection, you know, laws. What they'll do is they'll just create simple little things like, if you use my code, use only a beard. So in some cases, it is efficient.
Yeah. Yeah. And we have the case of the open source software movement, mm-hmm. where you're explicitly avoiding IP law, but you're using IP law in order to avoid IP law because people know how the open source software works, but basically part of the open source rule is I can't take your open source program, modify it, and close it. How do you prevent that? Because that would be violating your copyright, because your copyright basically licenses it to people only on condition that they keep it open. So that's the case where you're using IP law in order to maintain an anti-IP, as it were, without IP, a structure for producing stuff. Yeah.
Would one example from the common law be the Supreme Court's Winter decision on injunctions where they declared that the public interest can trump all other elements in granting an injunction? Because that would seem as if it would eliminate altogether any economic analysis whatsoever under the rubric of just some public interest.
Unless that it depends on how they define public interest. If what they're saying is if the public interest shows that there is a general gain to people much larger than the gains from allowing the injunction. The example that I use is damages for
for Torsh's law of life. In traditional common law, prior to it being modified by statute, if I tortiously kill you, I do something, not deliberate murder, but I am negligent in ways to result in your dying, how much, what damages do I owe? See, you're only taking this course and making money, you know the answer. Not this course. A tort course. The answer is zero. The answer is your claim dies with you. That's been modified by statute, by wrongful death statute since then. That's why I was making the money by 1820. But if you just take the posters, with Poster's claim was about the common law and not about statute. I know somebody else who argued the other way around. Statute was that it's not sufficient. But it's hard to see how the right rule can be that there is no cost to be for negligently killing you because your life value is your right value. And it's even hard to see how the wrongful death statute can be right. Anybody know under current wrongful death statutes, how do we calculate how much I owe for negligently killing you? What's the calculation based on?
Isn't it somewhat based upon what the person was making or what are the potential earnings in the future, anything like that?
Could be. But what it's ultimately based on is the value of your life to other people, to your family, etc. And that's crazy because the person who values your life most is you, right? So that in principle, if you follow out the logic of the current law, if you are a really happy person who has no wife, no family, no friends, you just, you know, entertain yourself playing computer games or something, your life is worthless if I kill you. Too bad. And that's ultimately coming, I think, out of the original law, which held that if I injured you, that gave you a claim against me. But you're not around anymore, so therefore there's no reason to claim against me. And the solution to this problem in other traditional systems, in particular in systems like the legal system of Saudi period Iceland or traditional Islamic law, is that you can't inherit the claim. That there's a sense in which those systems are more economically rational than ours was. Because the basic rule is that if you kill someone, let me take Saga period Iceland, this is 100% out. This is one of my favorite legal systems. This was a legal system where when you kill, where there was no criminal law, and if you killed somebody, it's relevant to you. And if they won the case and you didn't pay, there was also no mechanism to make you pay. All that happened was the court announced you were now an outlaw and was legal to kill you. So very interesting system. But in any case, but in that system, if I kill you, your estate goes to your heirs. Well, your estate includes the fact that I owe you 200 ounces of silver for killing you, so that goes to your heirs. And in Islamic law, in traditional Islamic jurisprudence, if I kill you, your heirs, if I kill you in the equivalent of first-degree murder, in a more serious form of killing, your heirs have a choice. They can either retaliate, kill me in the way I told you, or accept a fixed money payment in camels, actually.
So it's fixed by the state?
No, state, in the theory of Islamic law, includes separation of state and law. In theory, it will not entirely in practice. The state has no rule in making law only according to judges. The law, I like to say that Islamic law is what American law would be like if law professors ruled the world. Because what determines the law is the opinion of the legal scholars derived from ultimately religious sources. So it's as if law is your article rather than the Supreme Court decision determines the law. But the system. And I should say that the king can also pardon the guilty. That general pattern is common to a lot of legal systems. Of various sorts. One of the other courses I teach, but not this year, is of course on legal systems very economics, which is a great deal of fun. That includes Heraclean Athens and Imperial China and Saga period Iceland and modern Amish. The Amish are really neat. It's quite fascinating. And incidentally, they're going to matter. The Amish have traditional birth rates and modern medicine, and their population doubling time is not much over 20 years. So by the time you're an old person, there are going to be 10 times as many allergies as there are now. Assuming that's but they're fighting students. And gypsies, becoming gypsies. But anyway, but lots of those have a more sensible system than English, or even I would argue that it now does. So anyway, let me go on. So Posner's, now the Posner conjecture is that the common law is economic efficiency. A different way you can use the analysis is to say the law ought to be economically efficient. So the same argument, if you say what rule would maximize the size of the pie. One thing you can do, use that to do is to try to explain why the rules are what they are, which might work or might not. Another is to say, well, we got the wrong rule. We'd like to have a bigger pie, so let's change negligence to strict liability or strict liability to negligence, or less as I am suggesting, they put in what's called hedonic damages, where hedonic damages means that when I kill you, I owe your estate compensation for the pleasures that you would have had in that life. Going back a bit, just because it's fun. In Jewish law, Maimonides discusses the question of tort and tort damages for injuries short of death. Now the question is, how do we find out how much I owe you for hurting your right arm? Of course, any economist would say what you need in order to measure values is a market. Well, Maimonides has a market, because there's slavery in that society. So the answer is, you say, if you were sold as a slave, how much less would you sell for with a crippled arm and without a crippled arm? That's the answer. Maimonides is a lot of fun. Now, how much of it is him and Tarek Delta? He's basically giving his account of a legal tradition that had gone for well over 1,000 years by then. I'm not certain, but I think Jewish law may be the best documented legal system in the history of the world. I don't know enough about Chinese to know if it's Chinese, but you've got a thick book written about 2,000 years ago describing the legal system. But nothing, if you look at Roman law, for example, the only sort of official body of Roman law before Justinian, who's like 6th century or something, maybe even that, is the Law of the 12 Tables, which we don't have all of, and which was very, very short. But the Jewish law is in great detail, quite back a long time. It's a lot of fun. But all of you, the basic, if any of you are second year students, I might teach you the course again next year. The basic idea of that course is that all human societies face about the same problem, that they solve them in an interesting variety of different ways, that there's no particular reason to think we're any smarter than people were in Pericles in Athens or Imperial China or Solid Period Iceland, so we just think all of them are grown up. And all of these are possible solutions to the problem. You can look at how they work in the sense. I like to claim that in at least one respect, the U.S. law is 1,000 years behind the cutting edge of legal technology, because in Saga period Iceland, tort claims were marketable. Okay. Right. Think about not only my case of death. Suppose somebody runs into your car, and you'd like to sue them, and you're not a lawyer. How do you figure out what lawyer will do the best job? You're an ordinary person. Very hard. I got a very simple solution. Suppose you could sell your claim. You can transfer your claim to a law firm, and you agree to testify, and they get all the money, and they pay you in advance, just auction it off at the highest price. Much simpler mechanism. The Saga period Iceland tort claim, where it matters there was the issue that actually raises that, is suppose in that system that you suffer an injury, but you are relatively powerless. You're an elderly person, you have no adult sons, there's nobody who will fight for you. What good does it do to outlaw somebody? Nobody will go kill him. All right? And in fact, you're going to even have a hard time winning your case because somebody will beat you up on the way to the court. And the solution to that, that's the equivalent of the modern problem of what happens if you're injured and can't afford a lawyer. It's really an inversion of the same problem. But they had a solution to it. Their solution was you sell it to somebody else who does have the resources to prosecute it. You take the money, whatever he agreed to pay for it. More important than you're getting the money, the person who injured you suffers consequences and therefore people won't injure you. So you're not sort of open season on you the way you would be otherwise. So
All right, I'll be talking about more stuff next time. In general, read the chapters and figure out what seems to be wrong or you don't understand or whatever, and we can talk about that. A couple of things that we'll be talking about next time, and you can think about it, assuming you don't have too many questions. One of them is value, the whole idea of what economists call revealed preference, that is, we judge values by actions. And the other is what economists refer to as the coordination problem. And the standard version of this is to point out that there is no human being alive who knows how to make a pencil. Because in order to make a pencil, you need wood. In order to have wood, you need chainsaws. In order to have chainsaws, you need steel and gasoline and a whole bunch of other things. And if you sort of run that chain back, if you think about all of the steps that go into producing anything at all in a modern society, you somehow have to coordinate the activities and knowledge of millions of people. And it's hard to see how can you possibly know what to tell everybody in that network to do. And so what we'll be discussing is the ways of solving that problem. And I'm basically going to be arguing that there are really only two approaches to solving that problem. And that in practice, legal systems use both of them. They have to use both of them. My first is to say there are only two ways and one of them doesn't work. But that's an oversimplification because the one that doesn't work still has to get used. And one way is the decentralized mechanism. One way is the obvious solution to the problem, which is central control. The obvious solution is there's somebody up on top and he says, all right, you go mine some ore because we're going to need some ore to make steel. You mine some coal. You do this, and so forth. And that works catastrophically badly on the scale of a national economy. It's the Soviet already demonstrated. And it's the Chinese demonstrated, of course. And the other mechanism is the decentralized mechanism of something like a market system where you have prices signaling back and forth. But if you think through the kinds of problems a legal system has to deal with, some of them, it is hard to see how you can use the decentralized mechanism for all of it. So you really end up with a fairly difficult problem about which parts of the problem can you solve by individual choice and which parts of the problem does somebody up above have to say, I'm going to decide. So to take the very, then let me go back to my tort damages case earlier. That in one sense, strict liability for ultra-hazardous activities looks like the decentralized solution. Each individual guy says, shall I use dynamite to blow up my tree trunks? I've got the cost not only of the dynamite, but of the risk I'm imposing on other people. But what happens if he blows up a tree trunk and a bit of it hits you and it hurts you badly but doesn't kill you? How do we find out the value? How do we find out what damages he owes? There isn't a market price for that. So that looks like one where somebody has to look down from above and say, all right, the court says this damage is worth so much. So that's one example. We can discuss that point at greater length. It's one of the things that I don't think I discussed in the book because it hadn't occurred to me at the time when I was writing it, but that it's interesting that sort of the usual view of at least of sort of most modern economists, is centralized control doesn't work, markets do. And then when you start trying to apply it to law, you see that there are limits to that. Yeah.
Could you argue that there is a market for calculating damages now because you can just look at cases in which there was a similar type of accident with a similar type of person and figure out what kind of damages were awarded in those?
But that isn't a market. That was because those weren't awarded. Those damages don't reflect at what price I'm willing to have have the injury. It only reflects what the court decided.
Right.
But the court isn't making its decisions for himself. No. Where you could conceivably have a market for it is if you imagine a case where you've got some activities whose risks are known and you're hiring people to do those activities. So if we say that if you drive a dynamite, suppose you say people who drive an ordinary truck have one chance in 1,000 of getting killed each year, and people who drive dynamite trucks have 2 chances in 1,000. So in principle, you're going to say, how much more do you have to pay people to drive dynamite trucks? And that would be a market one, but it's hard to even apply that to the general case. All right, I think we're out of time. See you all Wednesday. Read the readings, and please think about them.